I would like to welcome you to today's webinar titled Transmission, Construction Through Operation and Maintenance. I want to thank each of you today for taking the time to join the seventh webinar in the Transmission Webinar Series that is being given in cooperation with the Bureau of Land Management and NREL. The Bureau of Land Management Washington office recognizes with declining budgets, travel restrictions, and heavy workloads that it's difficult to get away from your office to attend training. So BLM and NREL have developed this webinar series to inform as many federal agencies, staff, and managers as possible regarding electric transmission markets, electric grid overview, transmission planning, transmission permitting, as well as construction and maintenance activities. As you can see from the map on your screen, the BLM is facing over 25 high voltage transmission projects. These projects span 11 states and affect about 58 BLM field offices. Many of these transmission projects affect other federal agencies such as U.S. Forest Service, Fish and Wildlife Service, National Park Service, and Bureau of Indian Affairs. So we have invited them to join us on these webinars as well. The Department of Interior Secretary Jewell and the BLM Principal Deputy Director Corns has placed a high priority on timely and effective transmission permitting projects. Now, with an aging electrical infrastructure in continued emphasis on expanded generation from renewable and natural gas, our transmission workload is expected to remain high. So it's important that our BLM managers and staff have a solid understanding of these transmission projects. We hope that you find this webinar series informative, and we are going to record these webinars and make them available at a later date on the Knowledge Resource Center hosted by BLM's National Training Center. Thank you again, and now I'd like to introduce today's speaker, Karen Stackpole from HDR Engineering. Karen is a biologist and project manager with over 17 years of experience. She has conducted and led a variety of projects from endangered species surveys, wetland delineation, habitat assessment surveys, and long-term environmental monitoring programs. Over the last several years, Karen has focused on managing environmental efforts at large construction projects, and she has led multidiscipline teams of up to 60 resource specialists consisting of biologists, archaeologists, general compliance monitors, and paleontologists. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and pass it on over to Karen. Karen?
Okay, hi. Good afternoon. Here we go. Okay, next slide. There we go. Okay, let's just jump right into it. The topics that we'll cover today, this is a big mix of some topics that I've been asked to touch on, and then we'll get into construction and then a little bit of the processes for the phases. So we'll touch on access roads, temporary construction space, erosion control devices, soils and geotechnical studies, fire, water, vegetation management. Then we'll step back and get into the sequence of events. We'll go back to the beginning and talk about the equipment construction we'll use, helicopter, constructing with helicopters, and then take a step back again in the next section, processes for all phases. We'll go right back to planning phase, pre-construction, construction, and how to implement all of our mitigation measures to protect resources, and a little bit on operations and maintenance. Okay, next slide, please. Okay, our basic sequence of events. This is pretty much an overview here, but let's just start with, just so we have an overview, staking the right-of-way, center line, your work pads, and your road boundaries. Next, we're going to go to building roads and work areas, excavating, installing foundations, anchors, assembling and erecting structures, stringing your wire, grounding efforts, reclamation. So, yeah, that sounds simple enough, but let's go to the next slide and let's get into it. And we all know that that's not as easy as it sounds. Okay, next slide. Thanks. Creating access roads. So here's kind of a, here's a snapshot of, we'll get into this a little bit later, but creating access roads, what it takes. Here's a list of the possible equipment that could be used and likely would be used to create some of our access roads, and a few photos of all of the heavy equipment that's going to come in. Equipment's going to come in on low boys, and we need several dozers and excavators with all sorts of attachments, certainly a couple of graders and rollers to follow. for whatever reason, there always seems to be a backhoe or two when I'm out there with the construction contractors creating roads. Loaders, if they're bringing in gravel and gravel trucks. A hydro axe, here's an interesting piece of equipment that I encountered on a project a couple of years ago. I don't have any photos of it because we weren't even allowed to get near this piece of equipment. But if you don't know what this is, it's kind of like a very large lawnmower, believe it or not, on maybe what might look like an excavator or a grader. And this will clear an area of trees and stumps and vegetation very quickly. It's for dense clear. It's when it's very dense on a work pad, say, and we're going to clear a 100 by 100 foot area. So lots of problems with that piece of equipment, as you can imagine. Of course, nesting season, we have to survey the area. And, of course, a pretty large buffer because, as it turns out, the hydro axe will have pieces of tree stumps and everything else flying out of this thing over 100 feet. So certainly an interesting piece of equipment and posed a lot of problems for us resource managers. But I put that in there because it certainly was a surprise piece of equipment we didn't expect when creating access roads in our work pads. So I just put that in there, a little bit interesting. You can Google hydro axe and see some pictures of this equipment while it's working. We just cleared the area and stayed away. continuing on our possible equipment list, pickup trucks. Every manager has to have their own truck, so we've got a line of pickup trucks, water trucks, and water bugs. And then after the fact, you know, as they follow, you may have chippers and guys with chainsaws, mechanic trucks. Well, all this equipment needs maintenance. And, yeah, we may have to do some blasting to create our road or clear our work pad, and that may be the most feasible thing to do. So we may need dynamite also. So kind of shock value here slide, but what it takes. We'll get into this a little bit more. Okay, let's keep going on the next slide with access roads. Okay, I like this slide here. Types of access roads. Certainly for construction, we're creating a lot of temporary roads that are going to be restored. Permanent, we'll use permanent roads, some that are going to be created and they're going to stay as permanent roads. Spurs off of temporary or permanent roads, existing BLM roads, these are public roads. So we may have other traffic on these roads, two tracks, and then drive and crush or overland travel where we've flagged a route and we're not going to drop a blade on this. We're just going to drive on the vegetation in hopes of keeping the seed bank right there in place. I put this map up. This kind of illustrates, here's a list of, you see at the top of the map, there's about 10 numbers there. Those are our structure numbers and all the dots are our structures. Down at the bottom, you have a yellow line that's running like in an east-west direction. That's a existing BLM road. And then you have AR, access road, 13-1, 15-1, 13-2. Those are existing BLM roads. Anybody can drive on those. And then you have the purple line up by the structure numbers. And those are spurs off of the travel route, which is our route from structure to structure, but occasionally you have spurs off of it. So lots of activity going on in this map. What this map is also depicting is like this green highlight on the east-west direction road at the bottom of the map. Gravel needs to be placed there. There's a brown dash line between 51 and structure 51 and 52. Terrain's too difficult. We're just not even going to create an access road there. And same thing between structure 55 and 56. Big Canyon, we're not going to create an access road there at all. Instead, between 55 and 56, you could see a purple line that loops way up, and they did find access eventually. So we did have a route there. But just a big mix of what can be going on with our access roads and what that could look like at the end of the day on a map. Okay, next slide. All right, some of our key points for access road construction. To the extent possible, let's plan to use existing roads, and then we construct spurs off of that. Construction is going to want to use that anyway. Existing roads are already there. They don't need to construct. It's easier. Boundary flagging is key for areas where we're going to be creating roads or spurs. Boundary flagging, so flagging your road on either side to keep construction within bounds so they understand your access road is 20 feet wide and 2 feet berms on either side, and anything beyond that, well, you need to ask permission anything beyond that, because that's the width of your road, or whatever's planned for the width of that road. Construction contractors, well, they often find that there's not enough roads, of course, but so they look at it from a cost perspective. It takes them money and time and extra water and extra labor to go, if you remember the map on the previous slide, to go way out on the existing access road and follow an existing access road and then up another existing access road, when they can just create a little spur, which is going to save them time and money. And a lot of times, from a resource perspective, that can be in the best interest also. It takes a lot of, there's a lot of dust that's created. Maybe they're constantly going by burrows that are active or what have you. But a lot of times that could be a better route, just to create a spur as opposed to keeping them on existing roads as much as possible. So you have to weigh your choices. Avoid resources that are going to be a problem for construction. This I put in here is just an interesting note. So of course we know where our resources are, but there's other sensitive areas that we should identify or be aware of during the mapping phase. So I gave an example, Caliche Dent. We were rerouting on one project, and construction, we'll route the road over here, and it was going to go over. The road was going to go through a Caliche Dent, and there were many out there. But it was a BLM, I think it was a BLM person, who said, well, you know, that's really good habitat down in the desert there. I think that we can, is there anywhere else we can go besides take out that Caliche Dent, because it's important habitat? And of course, just to, for somebody to be aware of these areas that are going to support species, whether they're sensitive or not, but in these environments is important. Rock outcrops or cliff faces, of course. And then, you know, how about you have an access road that's going to go by a cliff face, and, oh, gee, by the way, there's an owl that nests there. And so that might have to get – the access road might have to be closed at one point. So just interesting situations that we can be put in with access roads. And, of course, expect change. The contractor may find they need ingress-egress route on some work pads or turnaround or – frequently a wider road in the bend of a road, just due to terrain or what other conditions. But certainly expect change. And we'll get into that expect change when we talk about variance or deviation requests later on. Okay, next slide. Thank you. Okay, so what I want to highlight here, we've talked enough about access roads, but what I want to highlight here is I love this picture. AR-70-1, Access Road 70-1. I know right where I am on the project. So proper signage, proper flagging, the blue and white flagging right underneath that sign indicates an access road on this particular project. So I know right where I am, and I love that picture. It helps everybody understand, yes, I can go on this two-track here. Maybe there's a road where it's a two-track, it's an existing road, but it is not open for the project, and it needs to be identified with a sign just like this, no project access. So part of your flagging and signage plan over there to the left, that's an important part. How about can a helicopter be used to create access as opposed to access roads? I mean, I had a statistic from Sunrise Power Link that I looked up, and they used a lot of helicopter. I have a video that we'll show in a little bit with constructing by helicopter. But they, on that project, it was a statistic off of their project website, and it said they had eliminated about 60 or 70 miles of access roads because they constructed with helicopter for certain areas. And of course, I think it ended up being feasible for them to construct with helicopter versus building access roads and bringing that equipment in because the terrain was so difficult in some areas there. If you know that project, Sunrise Power Link, San Diego and Imperial County. We'll get into that in a little bit also. How about seasonal restrictions? Are your access roads going to go through areas for sage grouse? And are you going to have seasonal restrictions or big game restrictions? Point of everything, all these slides with access roads is this obviously requires an advanced planning and pretty detailed planning to understand where construction needs to be, how they need to get that equipment in there, and how they're going to construct it. And, of course, with creating the minimal amount of roads and using what's available. And that's really the point of the access road slide. Okay, we'll go into the next topic. Next slide. Temporary construction space. Okay, actually, I had a photo that was on the right of the slide here, I was referencing that. It's funny. We'll get it. That's okay. So temporary construction space, these are areas that they're intended to restore at the completion of the project. And this photo that was to the right here was of a pole site. And it kind of took my breath away on this project a couple of years ago. Pole site must have been, it was about 300 feet in length, and it was completely cleared, and it was leveled. And it was all graded, and the contractors insisted they needed that much room for their pole sites. And it was huge, and they understood the implications of clearing the pole site that large. They would be responsible for restoring it, but they insisted they needed it, and I assume that they did. I don't really remember when they were using that exact pole site. But anyway, the areas that they're going to have to restore, work pads. So at every structure pad, all of their pole sites, and they have those at corners and various places throughout the right-of-way. Storage and staging areas, they have lots of, every time I turn around, there's another thing they need to have a staging area for. Water tanks, or just tankers. Topsoil storage, gravel storage, maybe they're storing vegetation. Heavy equipment, a lot of times they just need areas to park a dozer and a grader and a fuel truck or something, just because they're not using it for this week, but they know they're going to use it in a few weeks. Refueling areas, concrete batch plants, those are huge. Trailers, maybe they just trailer equipment in and out. Wire reels and poles and all their materials. It comes from, so next check, it comes from the materials yard, so they need to transport it out to the right-of-way, and then from the right-of-way get it to the structure pad, get it to the structure pad so that they can assemble it, and helicopter landing zone. Those are the big ones for temporary. Those should be temporary construction areas only. Okay, next slide. Okay, erosion control devices. I have two or three slides here in a small video. Let's just start at the beginning of time, our erosion issue. So we have the potential for erosion. There's a slope, we removed vegetation, we're using heavy equipment, we've got rain or wind, we've got some soil types that just aren't compacting. That's our erosion issue. The photos on this slide, the top photo, they have their ECDs in place. I remember taking this photo years ago, and it just always seemed funny to me that they had the silt fencing so far up on the bank on either side. But, you know, A for effort. I'm not sure if I took this. I can't remember now to the right outside of the photo if it just the slope was a little bit too much for that one wattle, I suspect. But it looks like they had a couple of bales down below in front of the silt fencing, so that might be adequate to maintain flow. But you can see they're going from they constructed a road up here outside of the photo, and you have created a lot of slough, and they've got a drainage down below. Bottom photo looks like a newly installed silt fence and a straw wattle in front of it. That looks fine. How about some example variety of mitigation measures here? So we can use a helicopter in certain areas, and that can minimize impacts. We need to do water bar installation across the roads while we're on a slope. Reseeding and returning the topsoil to the natural contour of the land. that'll help in erosion, cross drains, installing cross drains, temporary culverts. I've got a funny video, if it'll show in a little bit, of a little tiny culvert in a very large drainage. Temporary culvert installation if necessary, but, of course, being aware of and making sure that contractors are aware of 404 requirements and not exceeding the one-tenth of an acre impact. New roads, well, if we're constructing new roads, we need to follow the topographic relief of the road. And it almost seems like it's second nature to us and to those in that are operating heavy equipment. But occasionally, sometimes there's just a road that doesn't seem to make any sense and doesn't follow topographic relief. So always be aware of that basic principle of following topographic relief. Closed roads that are not intended for project use, well, let's not have any impacts on those roads that we're not supposed to be using for the project. Maybe we decided we're not going to use those for the project, so the contractor doesn't have to be responsible for those. Well, we need good signs or a road closure sign or a gate or something that indicates to all project personnel that road is not for project use. Even things such as reducing speed, keeping the speed low, will help with this, and using mats and wet clay soils if it's possible. And, of course, certified weed-free materials should be included in your straw wattles and straw bales and stuff. We'll get into that a little bit later, too. Let's go to the next slide. Okay, a few photos, a few examples here. I have this just in case the video doesn't work in the next slide. So ineffective, or they're just not present at all. Top two slides, looks like the contractor graded the road, put some silt fencing in, and it just overtook. It looks like they regraded or something, and they overtook the silt fencing there. So that's not effective. What does that mean? They just need to, ECDs, as I call them, they need constant maintenance. They need constant maintenance and repair. So, okay, you regraded your road, and it looks like you had a little slough spillover. Now you need to fix your ECD. The photo on the right, this is kind of interesting because it's a little bit of a different scenario than we usually see. This road was built way up as opposed to coming more to a point at the center and tapering down as a typical road would be constructed. But you can see here, the silt fencing was put in, and it's just too close. They have too much slough that's coming off of the edge of that row, of the top of the road. So that's in need of some major repairs. And down the bottom, non-existent. There should be some silt fencing. Looks like they got some ponding going on in the left photo. And to the right, I see a lot of vegetation clearing and stuff. That's great. My point with that photo is a lot of times even the silt fencing, that'll keep the contractors right in bounds. You're not going to be exceeding the boundaries of the silt fencing. So that's just another tool to help keep everybody in bounds. Okay, let's go to the next slide. Okay, this is the video. We'll watch the video first.
The water's going to flow right through. There's no culvert pipe over there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just going to go right through the road and blow out the road out the other way, unless there's a culvert behind those rocks. Can't see from here. So we need to go down there and take a look.
Okay.
But
These two
here.
Could those be effective in a
flow? Not really, not with the amount of water that could potentially come down through here.
Right.
That's not going to be doing much of anything.
Okay, thanks, Courtney. So that video was just a clip of a conversation. If you could see when the video panned up to the left side, you could see a little tiny culvert. Now that's a very large drain. That's a very large drainage there. So that culvert would never be expected to meet the demands that if there was a large rain event, that it wouldn't work. It would overtake that road. It would come right down the canyon in front of where those people were standing, and then as they pan to the right in the beginning, it would just blow out. It seems like the road kind of circled around there, and it would just blow out that road that connected that circle and push right through. So they ended up you know, in the straw wattles that were there, the two that were facing the people in the video, those would be completely ineffective. And they had one that was that ran the length of the of that drainage. You know, truth be told, after they after we had this conversation, the contractors, they admitted they were just in the middle of it. They were trying to do something real quick because there was a rain event that was planned. They ended up shoring that with riprap and properly putting in their ECDs a little bit better. And they did end up eventually putting in a larger culvert to accommodate any flow that could the flow that could potentially come through that canyon. So so good ending to the story. We caught them kind of mid-act there, but it at least demonstrates some of the completely ineffective ECDs. Okay, next slide, please. Okay. Like I said in the beginning, I was asked to talk about some topics that I couldn't really relate to here and there. And well, we're talking about soils, so I'll talk a little bit about the geotech studies. I was asked just to touch on this topic, so I apologize if we're skipping around a little bit, but just to catch on some of these topics. So geotechnical, we're back in the planning phase here. We're evaluating the soil conditions. Look in the lower box here, geotechnical parameters. This is the samples that we're collecting. This is what they're going to be this is what they're going to be sampled for. Water content, porosity, specific gravity, organic content, and the percent fines. What kind of soil are we looking at? So why do they need I'm not an engineer, but why do they need to know this information? Well, the engineers will use this information, so they design the foundations and the structures. They'll decide if they need to cut material, bring in engineered fill. It's all to support the foundations and these structures. There's so much force on these structures and the wires and the foundations that this is a key point. I mean, your structures are going to fall down if you don't have the right base for them. So one other thing that the geotechnical studies that you'll find with the geotechnical studies, they'll test for resistivity, so the corrosive potential. So we'll see if what structures need to be grounded. And overall, it'll give you some of the geologic conditions of the area. And I don't want to go much more beyond that. I just want to emphasize the importance of this and note to all of us resource specialists, it's just another thing we need to have in the back of our mind. We don't need to be geologists. We can be natural resource folks or whatever, but we need to have an understanding of this needs to be done, this box needs to be checked so that the engineers can design the right foundations and structures. Okay, next slide. All right, another, there's no rhyme or reason to going from geotechnical to fire, but another topic asked to touch on, fire hazards. So BLM lands were typically located in the fire-prone landscape more times than not, and now we're going to construct out there. We're bringing in hazardous materials and petroleum. We've always got high winds and lightning strikes to deal with. Now we're going to be welding. We could be welding. We certainly have a lot of sparks from equipment that's bumping into rocks and whatnot. We're out there blasting sometimes. And how about, I always see contractors leaving their vehicles or their equipment and they leave them running and they're over dry vegetation. Sometimes you get some old school people who are surprised that they are not able to burn debris or trash out there. So, okay, just follow the arrow across ways to maybe just help mitigate some of these issues. First off, how about providing workers with a district phone number or dispatch to report fires? I like to, at the beginning of a project, maybe hand out stickers, and folks can put it on their, it could be part of the sticker on their hard hat for the environmental training. It could be a sticker that they put on their on the steering wheel of the truck or something like that. How about enforcing a project-wide communication system? That's an incredibly valuable tool. We'll get into that a little bit. Enforce each equipment, each vehicle has firefighting equipment. Not that everyone has to be a firefighter or even have specialized training, but I think that each vehicle that's out on the right-of-way needs to have shovel, pulaski, a jug of water or like a fire pump type thing that's just secured to the back of their truck. Enforce no burning, of course, and enforce that vehicles are equipped with spark arresters. So a few ways that we can at least prevent fire hazards. Okay, next slide. Water use. This is kind of funny to me because dust is just one of my biggest pet peeves, and this slide looks so skinny, but why do they need so much water? So they need water to control dust when they're constructing and when vehicles are using the roads, and secondarily, as important, they need to use the water when they're compacting soils on the roads and the pads during construction. Well, let's go back to controlling dust. It's a monumental task in some areas. It depends on your soils, but it's a monumental task to control the dust. It ties into, water is sometimes hard to come by in such remote areas, so contractors have to go far off site to bring water in. A lot of times they'll bring it in with tankers, and then the tankers will be staged at the right-of-way, so then water trucks or a water bug can fill from a tanker, and then the tankers go back and forth. So it's an entire process, and I can't remember if I get into this later on. I'll just mention it here. A lot of times if you're in an area where you're in a non-attainment area for meeting EPA air quality, Las Vegas, Phoenix, Tucson area, something like that, there may be some other areas, but you need to control dust such that there's no visible dust. And so you're constructing and you cannot have any visible dust. So let's say construction is clear in the work pad. We need to be spraying water to keep the dust down. We need to be spraying water back and forth on access roads, and everyone needs to keep their speed down so that we're not generating dust. At the end of the night, we get almost back construction out of the right-of-way, and the last one out is the water truck, and they will crust over that or attempt to crust over the access road so it's not blowing when we're not on the site. So lots of processes to deal with dust and lots of water use. One other mention on dust control, be aware that, a lot of times I hear contractors want to do an additive to water. So it'll crust over I haven't used additives before to water, but I hear a lot of requests for it. Likely those can't be used in sensitive habitats anyway. So their application may be limited, but just something to be aware of. Okay, next slide. Vegetation management. Let's see. Let me just touch on this a little bit, and then we'll go. We'll get to that in operations and management slide too. Danger trees. So this middle picture here, this tree is marked DT. It's a danger tree. It's a certain height that's expected to be too tall. So the right of way is going to need to be cleared. At some point during construction, they'll come up with chainsaws and clear the right of way. They can leave trees that, if you're in a PJ habitat or so, and there's a whole lot of height difference. The height difference is from the top of the tree to the bottom of the wire. I think it needs to be 20 feet. So I'm not 100% certain on that, but that's what I remember. So we had some pinyon junipers that were real small, and it would have taken, I don't even know when they would ever achieve that height. So, of course, things like that were left and were allowed to be left within the right-of-way. Tree trimming during operations and maintenance, we'll get to that a little bit. It's not as frequently as I think as everybody fears. So we'll get to that later. Let's go to the next slide. Okay. Sequence of events. So next slide. This is we'll get into construction here. Let's go back and look at a little more detail of the sequence of events. And we'll go through these kind of quickly because these are more, they're kind of shock value. Sequence of events, road construction, and work pad. Actually, I forgot to put in the work pad construction, which is equally as important. ECD installations and then ongoing repairs. And then footing installation will come in. Well, we need concrete or select fill needs to come in. Maybe we're doing precast foundations and anchors need to be installed if we have guy wires. well, then the anchor testing crew needs to come in and make sure those anchors are okay. They're going to support the tensioning for the guying, So structure hauling. Now we have a line of trucks bringing in our monopoles or parts of lattice structure assembly. Then they have to assemble it on the work pad. Cribbing, that's where they'll use blocks of wood to elevate pieces of the structure so that a crane can pick it up. Structure erection or structure setting, that's where we're setting, and we'll need cranes on site to stand everything up. Guying, if we have structures that require guy wires. Wire installation, well, there's a whole lot involved in that, hanging travelers, hanging these wheels so that the lines will continue to move as we move down the line, stringing it, clipping them in. A lot of the wire installation can be completed by helicopter. I see that more frequently than not nowadays. Site development, civil work, that's a mistake. I was going somewhere else with that thought, and I apologize. That shouldn't be in there. That's really up at the top, and it just kind of encompasses road construction, work pad construction, and dirt moving in general. Fencing and gate installation, a lot of times I see new gate repairs and things like that being that the contractor is doing. ECD repairs, it's an ongoing process. Trenching to support grounding, restoration activities. So there's still a whole lot more in between all of these, you know, as you move through road construction, and then ECDs are coming through, and then footing installation comes out, and then they start pouring concrete, and behind them they start bringing out the structures, and then behind them another crew is going to start assembling them. So it almost looks like a production line as we start the project, and then a little bit of the ways in, then it seems to get a little bit mixed up, and then all of a sudden we're going to string wire on the northern part of the project while the southern part's still under construction and still undergoing civil work. So a lot of flexibility, a lot of planning to make sure everyone is in the right place. Certainly that's understandable with a large utility project like this. Okay, let's keep going to the next one, and we'll go through these kind of quickly. So our civil work. We already saw this part of the screen earlier. Some of the equipment being used. A load of equipment just to build our roads and our work pads. Okay, next slide. Our footing installation, we're bringing in concrete, select fill. Maybe we have precast foundations or with anchors and anchor snubs, tensioning if there's guy wires present, and a whole list of equipment to use for that activity. Okay, next slide. Structure hauling, assembly, cribbing, and then structure erection and structure setting. This could be maybe just one or two crews. Maybe they haul in everything for a certain maybe 20 structures. And then they come back and then they start assembling it. And then some of the guys will go back and start cribbing. And then some and get all the way through, and then some will start erecting, and then they'll move to the next 20 or 50 structures. It depends on many conditions. Maybe road construction got slowed down or something like that, so they have to readjust. But it's just the flexibility and the amount of people moving back and forth and different tasks that need to be completed. It's just not all, it is a sequence of events, but it ends up, I guess my point is, it just ends up being, it ends up being a little mixed up in the end. Here's, of course, during assembly, you've got cranes that are on site. You can see in that photo right there, one of the cranes is holding part of the lattice, and the other one is lifting, that middle section onto it. So you've got a work pad that, if you look at work pads in the beginning of time, in the beginning of the project, you think, that's pretty big. I don't know why they need that much room. And once you start seeing the way that the project moves and what tasks need to be completed, I occasionally find contractors say, I can't fit all of this equipment on this work pad and still keep the access road clear, for traffic, and they end up needing some additional space, some additional workspace. So let's go to the next slide. We'll keep on cruising through these. Okay, wire installation, hanging traveler, string and clipping. Awful lot of pullers and tensioners, cranes and trucks that are required to string. Let's just go to, I have helicopter as the last piece of equipment here. Most of the projects that I've worked on, they have strung via helicopter. Not all, but most of them. I have a video, I think it's the next slide, and a couple, just a little side note, a couple months ago I was at a presentation, or I was at a conference, and a fellow from San Diego Gas and Electric had presented this video for Sunrise Power Link, and it was just a really great video of all their helicopter use. They constructed a lot with helicopter. So instead of my shaky video, which seemed a little boring, of them clipping it in and moving to the next structure, this is a really well put together. It's on YouTube, and I apologize. We have to watch a, like, five-second advertisement because this is right off of YouTube. But it's a great – it's a four-minute video, and it's just put the music. It's really great. So let's do the next slide and see if we can watch that. Oh, okay. I thought it was – maybe I put it after the next one. Okay, I think that's – maybe it's in a couple slides. I'm sorry, I forget. Fencing and gate installation, I always see the contractors repairing fences and gates and making great improvements to the gates also. Next slide. And trenching and grounding activities, trenching, dozers, boom trucks, what have you, if the structures need grounding. Go ahead, next slide. Okay, here's the video.
We know everyone's looking for ways to save. Why not save on car insurance? Visit progressive.com for a free quote.
Thanks.
You're welcome. Get a free quote at progressive.com.
You can see in this video, they've hauled in materials. They probably fly in the crew. They've hauled in drill rigs and all their equipment to these locations here where they did not build access roads. And look at that terrain. Thank you. this is what I typically see, where they're stringing wire. There's a traveler. Hook it on and then pick it up on the other side of the structure and then bring it to the next set of structure. Okay, so I just wanted to show that video. Obviously, it's really well put together, and it's a lot better than the shaky videos I have of wire stringing. But certainly shows the benefits of using a helicopter. They're not used all the time. I mean, they still constructed a lot of access roads with that particular project. They still constructed a lot of access roads because that's still much more cost-effective than using a helicopter to deliver construction workers, deliver heavy equipment, and all of the materials and such. But you can see that it's obviously, it seems like it's a pretty good cost savings to use a helicopter to string wire, and that's commonly what we see. Okay, so this next phase three of the presentation, processes during each phase. So this is sort of my little more of my favorite part, where we can talk a little bit more about mitigation and some of the mitigation measures that we can use. We'll go back to the beginning of time. Let's go back to the planning phase. Next slide. Okay, in the planning phase, let's start in the beginning of time. We've done our surveys to support the EIS. We're in the preparation of a construction operations and maintenance plan, the COM plan. This is our guidance Bible during construction. There's many times that folks will just say on the project, you have a question, go find the answer in the COM plan. So a well-prepared COM plan, I couldn't ever say it enough, a well-prepared COM plan is really key to a well-run project. That being said, there's absolutely no way that a COM plan could really address every issue that comes to be on a project, because you just can't ever have that level of detail. But if you're not familiar with the COM plan, this is BLM's document. This is the construction considerations and practices. These are the reports that will go into the COM plan. So on the construction end of things, the construction plan, how are they going to build it? Transportation, how are they going to get the materials in? Blasting plan, what's the process for blasting? When are they going to do it? What materials are they going to use? Flagging, fencing, and signage. This is an extremely important plan. What color does red flagging tape mean? Does that mean that this is an exclusion area and I shouldn't go in there? Or does that mean that this is an access road? So everybody's on the same page. Erosion control, dust control plans, air quality, water quality plans, fire, hazmat, emergency preparedness, communications plans should be in there also. So lots of planning in the beginning that should be into the comp plan. How about environment on the environmental side of the house? Bio, cultural, paleo, air quality, land use, deviation requests, variation, change requests, whatever you want to call them. We'll get into that in a second. Construction scheduling and coordination. How many managers meetings are we going to have every month or week or whatever? Environmental training program. What is that program going to look like and how are you going to administer it? And reporting. How often does BLM want to be informed of issues or what's our final reporting going to look like? Next slide. Okay. Touch a little bit on cultural resources in your comp plan. Historical properties treatment plan and ARC monitoring plan. Same thing for paleo. Biggest point to take away from this slide here is let's recognize there's a constant risk that we're going to have an unanticipated discovery. So how are we going to deal with that? We're blading a road, and oh my gosh, we just uncovered a bunch of charcoal. I think it's a hearth. What do we do? We'll address that in a second. Next slide. Bioresources. This is another slide that makes me laugh because much like water and dust control seem to be my biggest pet peeve, bioresources, which is my background, this slide looks really skinny. But, of course, you have everything you need right here, your BO, your APP, BPP. If you have agriculture, completely different issue, noxious weed management plan. So you've got your answers within these documents, but again, with the same unanticipated discovery. We have a bird nest. Burrowing owls moved in here. What are we going to do, and how do we address those? Let's keep going. Okay, we'll kind of melt into the next phase here. These kind of overlap a little bit. Pre-construction phase, kickoff meeting. Let's start with having a kickoff meeting. BLM attend the kickoff meeting to provide environmental training for managers. What's in our environmental training? We can have general environmental compliance training. We can have a species-specific environmental training if needed. Let's go over to the box on the right. So what could be in our training program? Well, this is just a sampling of what's in our training program. Speed limit. Are we all going to do 20 or less? What's our speed limit? We need to keep the dust down, and we need to recognize we're on unpaved roads. Seasonal closures. What are those areas for seasonal closures? Roads that are closed, and why are they closed? Why they're closed? We need to provide everyone on the project. It's an education program, and we need to provide everybody on the project with an understanding of why we're asking. Good housekeeping. Why do we ask you to sweep out your vehicle and throw your trash in a waste receptacle that has a cover on it? Well, I mean, just to explain to everyone why is a lot of the process that we need to go through. How about require firefighting tools? We talked about that. Identify sensitive species or areas that are located nearby or within the right-of-way. Migratory Bird Treaty Act surveys. How are we going to handle that? The contractor needs to be able to recognize what their expectations are going to be when we find a nesting bird and how it's going to affect them. And that leads right into our process for variance requests. So some of these topics here only provide in the environmental training for managers. I think that for other project personnel, they don't really need to understand so much the process for variance requests or how we're going to handle migratory bird treaty surveys and how that's going to affect the contractor. Other project personnel who are also receiving the training, but they need to understand, once I see flagging and a sensitive resource sign, I can't go into that area. So maybe is it a different training for each group of people? But how about the timing of administering the training for species-specific training? Recent project I was on started in the north end of the project a year later, when we were in the south end of the project, well, that's when we were in desert tortoise habitat. Good thing we didn't provide the sensitive species training for desert tortoise at the beginning of the project, because everyone would have forgotten by the time they got to tortoise habitat. So drew a line in the sand, and this everything south of here is tortoise habitat, and this is whenever you're entering the right-of-way south of this line, that's when you need to have your species-specific tortoise training and different stickers for each training. And, of course, documentation. I think it really means something when somebody checks the box and says, yes, I will comply with these rules, and I sign my name to it. That adds a little bit more formality to the program. Okay, next slide. Yeah, variance requests. Here's another difficult topic. It can be difficult. Number one, we need to enter this entire project with the understanding that there is going to be change. A variance request could be the result of an unanticipated discovery. Maybe they can't make a turn that they thought they could and need to have wider roads or access issues or whatever. Here's a real simple example of a variance request. Or deviation request or change request, whatever you call it. This photo, I took this photo a couple of years ago. It shows this is an overland travel route. We created this route to go around a bird nest. So behind the photo here, you can't see it. Outside the photo to the right, access road, we were continuing to create an access road. And, oh, we had surveyed the day before, and sure enough, there was a bird nest ahead. Contractor said, well, what do? We have to go around. We have to keep going. How do we do that without disturbing the bird nest and staying out of the buffer? So what did we do? We had a variance request process. The utility company, the CIC, who represents the BLM, the environmental monitors, biological, archaeological, and the construction contractor all were at the site. The route was flagged. The construction contractor said, this is the route that we choose. The environmental monitor said, okay, now we're going to survey this route. The utility company approved, yes, there isn't any other way. We need to go around this nest. We need to go around the buffer. This is an approved route. The CIC, the BLM representative, said, yes, this is what has to happen. This is a route that's going outside of the right-of-way, so this is a variance request. This is constructing outside of the right-of-way, and it was not planned. And it's an acceptable reason why. So lots of interesting situations and some that are real simple like this. Let's go to the next slide where we can see some of the differences, examples of variance requests. Maybe contractor needs a new access road. Maybe they want to use an existing access road they hadn't planned on for whatever reason. They need additional workspace. That's a common one. They need an additional staging area. They need more room on a work pad for whatever reason, terrain usually. Maybe their construction methodology is just a little bit different. They need to gravel a road. They're encountering rock, and they need to blast. That would be a deviation request. How about road widening? A lot of times they find they just need a wider road than 20 feet. They have very large trucks that are hauling heavy materials, and they may have traffic coming in either direction, and they need a wider road. Installation of gates and cattle guards, we see that frequently. But I don't want to put the responsibility, the cause of variance requests only on construction. Resource folks can be the cause of some variation requests as well. Unanticipated discoveries. We see them all the time, and we have to find a route, or construction has to go and construct in another place, which is not always easy. They have to remobilize everything to all of their equipment to another area of the right of way. It's not always feasible. That's when it's feasible for us instead to do a variance request and go around a feature or an unanticipated discovery. So, other examples, maybe the contractor might request to do something, to do a repair or something in an area under a seasonal restriction, so they'll have to ask for that. And BLM would have to consider if whatever species that seasonal restriction is for, if that's an acceptable request or not. Reroutes, maybe they need to clear additional vegetation, or landing zones and landing pads for helicopters. I see this one quite a bit, and I think this is because maybe helicopter and the pilot is not under contract until the construction contractor is, and I think it's the pilot that will clear the area and say, this is where I want to land. So it's maybe that's like a late change. So I see that one fairly frequently on projects. Regardless, the point of the variance request slides are change will happen. We can't anticipate everything during routing siting. So expect change. And it's not, in some cases, in many cases, it's not a bad thing. I mean, what's the difference of going 100 feet straight ahead versus we're going to go 100 feet around this feature or something, an archaeology feature or something like that? There's no difference. It's just a matter of it's something we need to request for and do the paperwork properly to be able to do that work. Okay, next slide. Okay, kind of melt into the construction phase here. So we've talked about our general environmental training programs and the importance of documentation. We need to implement a well-thought-out variance request process, and let's implement our mitigation measures. Here's kind of where us as resource professionals will. This is more of our comfort zone here. Let's go to the next slide and just go over some mitigation measures during construction. So habitat protection during the construction phase, how are we going to do it? I'm frequently asked, well, you have all of this, you have so much construction going on and so much heavy equipment and so many laborers. How do you, and so many plans to be in compliance with, how do you tie it all together? When it's boots on the ground, how do you actually do it? And all of these points bring us to, all of these points keep us in compliance and get the contractor, which is the ultimate goal, to get the contractor from point A to point B in compliance. So some examples, and there's many, many, many more, as I'm sure everyone's aware. Your flagging plan, I can't tell you enough of, I'm such a big fan of flagging, not spray paint, but flagging. Prior to ground disturbance, a biomonitor surveys and inspects. Project personnel is told they have to stay out of exclusion areas. We don't say what type of resource we are protecting. We just say there is a resource, and that's the only information that personnel need to know. A lot of times they end up understanding what it is, but sometimes it's just better just to say it's a resource, and that's all that we tell folks. When we do have a nest, we don't, you know, my personal preference is I don't flag at the nest. Of course, I flag 10 or 20 feet north of the nest, or we have some kind of agreed upon code for the biological monitors anyway. Because I don't want a flagging tape at a nest, and I certainly don't want to attract anyone to come and look and, oh, what's that that's flagged over there? Oh, it's a bird nest, and I just stepped on it. So just something to be aware of. How about enforce a weed inspection program? Any equipment that comes into the site, it's coming from another job site. If it's got caked on mud, it's got weed seed that could be in that caked on mud. So we can't bring that onto the right of way. So wash stations in the staging yards, and after the contractor brings dirty equipment to the right of way a few times and has to go back to the staging area, they learn pretty quickly that they go to the staging area first, rinse their equipment, and then they can bring it out to the right of way. So a weed inspection program is definitely key for habitat protection. Where it's feasible, begin construction in a weed-free area and then move to a weed-infested area. Well, that's a loaded kind of comment because, A, we should be treating our weed-infested areas anyway, but, B, this comment really just it kind of speaks to – I like to explain to the contractors why things like this are important, or even the next bullet, sweep out vehicle cabs and dispose of trash and waste receptacle. I like to explain to them why. I had a contractor say, I have a banana peel. Why can't I throw that out? Why can't I throw that out in the right of way on the ground? It's gonna decompose. It's fine. Well, we're in critical habitat. We're in tortoise habitat, so that's not going to happen. And B, you know, explaining to them the reasons why predation and why we don't do that, it's just a matter of good housekeeping. So there's a lot of education is really the main point of that. Inspect your clothing, equipment, and vehicles for weed seed and plant parts. Separate topsoil to maintain the seed bank. So scrape off that A horizon, keep it to the side of the work pad, tackify that stockpile, so spray water on it so that it doesn't all blow away, because a lot of it will. And that photo right there is a topsoil pile, and it's labeled topsoil do not disturb. Don't step on it. Don't drive equipment up there, because then you're going to break that seal that's tackified so it doesn't blow. Use of exclusionary devices to protect sensitive plants. That's a common one for us. Erosion control devices. Sure, use them, but have any straw or hay bales. They should be state certified weed free. Water the work areas in the roads to control dust. That's a big one for me. Okay, let's keep going. There's many, many, many more. This is just a sampling of some of the mitigation measures, more common ones, or ones I wanted to highlight. Okay, protecting nesting birds during construction. Well, biological monitors should be present during the nesting season, basically April 1 to August 31, depending on where you are. Prior to ground disturbing, survey, inspect, flag your buffer for any nesting or breeding birds. I don't get into any raptors here. Maybe I should have, but I think that the buffers are worked out pretty well for raptors. I'd like to see up earlier in the project. It seems like every April 1, we are starting the survey, and yep, we ran into a active bird nest. Well, what kind of buffer would you like on it? I don't know. So I'd like to have buffers worked out for migratory birds earlier than when we first encounter one, so that we can keep construction moving. Seasonal restrictions, critical habitat, another measure of protecting. Maintaining slash on site if appropriate. This is another sort of loaded comment. And maybe this is something for discussion in a little bit. I frequently have supported leaving any vegetation that's cleared, leave it on site. It's great cover, and I don't see a problem with that. However, on a recent project that I was on, they chipped it instead and spread it and said, well, in a couple of years, that's fuel, so we don't want to do that. So two sides of the coin on that, and I'm not sure. It may depend on the habitat you're in. I'm not sure which way to go on that. So maybe we can discuss that in a little bit. Stay out of buffered areas that are flagged for nests or breeding pairs of birds. Install perch deterrents, of course, where appropriate. Next slide. Protecting sage grouse. I pulled out a few examples, sage grouse and tortoise. Like I said, I didn't get into raptors or big game or anything, but just some examples here of some mitigation measures. I mean, we could have parts of the right-of-way closed basically from November to June if we have winter habitat, active lex, and nesting all within the right-of-way. So just something to be aware of that, and also something for construction to be aware of. They need to know where these areas are that are closed so that they can plan appropriately for where they're going to be in the right-of-way at the right time. Okay, next slide. And desert tortoise construction projects. Of course, tortoise education program. We conduct pre-construction surveys, so we'll go through with it a week before and clear that right-of-way so that there are, at that point, we've scoped, we've excavated burrows, we've relocated, but then pretty much with equipment right behind us, we go through again. So equipment is starting up in the morning, and then we'll walk down the right-of-way again to where they're going to go towards the end of the day and clear that. And then there's a tortoise person with equipment. So any tortoise that happens to wander onto the site also is afforded that protection by the tortoise monitor also. So lots of very, species that's moving around a lot occasionally in the desert and difficult to see. So lots of surveys there to move them and relocate them and protect them. Stay on the roads and cleared areas. It may get to the point where on some projects, equipment and everyone coming into the right-of-way is escorted by environmental monitors. No pets, obviously. Prevent raven predation and nesting. Relocate and handle the tortoises only as needed. I got a good slide or a good photo in the next slide or two slides to show something like that. cover open holes overnight so tortoises don't fall in, enforce correct installation of tortoise fencing. That's an interesting one. I always find we're installing tortoise fencing around holes or whatever. It's the end of the day, and the contractor, they have some gaps, and they're getting aggravated because it's the end of the day, and they want to hurry up and go, but they have to install this fencing to these specifications. So what I do and what I have monitors do who have to enforce the correct installation of fencing is either, A, plan that your open holes, stop work earlier so your open holes are covered properly, but if you are going to do fencing around open holes or something like that, that you have a, there's a, you know, the guidance sheet, and we all go over it together so they understand why that fence has to be buried and how deep and things like that. It's difficult. It's a difficult process at the end of the day. And one that it seems like we fight about once in a while. Check under vehicles and equipment before moving, and monitors should be present with the work crews to help them, as their eyes on the ground during the high season. Okay, next slide. So this is pretty much it. Here's some examples. Some good photos that I had. And this first photo on the left, the environmental monitors identified an active nest just when we were clearing this access road up here. So they closed the area. It didn't affect anyone. We were kind of done up there, and it wasn't a big deal. So we did a sensitive resource sign and then ended up hanging some tape across the access road, and that was it. That was a pretty easy situation. Here's a real crazy photo on the right. Environmental monitors mitigated this potential take of desert tortoise. So you can see up in the top of the photo, there's a water truck, and here it comes barreling down the road. And here's a tortoise that's drinking out of some ponded water on the roadbed anyway from when the truck had passed through probably 10 minutes before. Now, this water truck operator, you know, they have their construction radio that they're talking to and getting the direction on where they're going to go next, and they're operating their sprayers and levers and driving their truck. So it's difficult for them to put the responsibility of, oh, and yes, you need to look for tortoise too. Of course, I don't think this tortoise is very hard to see for anyone to see, but smaller than that, it could be difficult for them to see. So this is a great photo. It just kind of captures the tension of the moment. And on this particular project, you know, that could have, well, I mean, I guess it could have been a take. I honestly don't know how the driver wouldn't have ever been able to see him if the monitor wasn't there. But regardless, if that was a smaller tortoise, maybe it could have been a take on the project. So next slide, just some interesting photos of, that I've captured here and there. So here's a photo on the left. That's a little hard to see. Maybe there's a monitor over there, and he's working closely with the operator in the dozer. And in the foreground here are some rare plants, and we flagged it off when we flagged each plant. And it's the resource monitor just working really closely with the operator, and really understands that operator. They have their own kind of hand language and eye contact. It's important, of course, that people are safe too while working on the ground, so they have that relationship so they can work safely near the equipment. And photo on the right, well, this was an active tortoise area. We had some tortoises walking around, and this is just simply a way to communicate to everyone on the project, stay in compliance. So reduce your speed, and about, I don't know if it was 100 or 300 feet up the road, it said, okay, resume your speed. So we had them reduce their speed to, I forget, 5 miles an hour, and then they resumed to 10 or 15 or whatever the speed limit was there. Next slide. Okay, so this is the last slide. It kind of ends in it doesn't end on an exciting note, resources so much, but operations and maintenance. I was asked to touch on this, and of course, I don't really have a very definitive answer to give. The utilities will conduct their operations and maintenance activities. It just completely varies. And sometimes it's a yearly thing, and sometimes it's up to every 5 years. 1 to 2 people will fly the lines. They'll inspect guy wires and the insulators and look at the wires. And in most cases, they're flying the lines now. On guide structures, they could have to get on the ground to check tensioning and things like that. You could have corrosion problems that's going to require them to be on the ground to look at switches. Ice storms or wind storms, those could trigger an inspection. So there could be events that triggered inspection. or it could just be a yearly or even biannual inspection. Two other things, easements. I don't know if that's really such an issue on BLM land, but certainly they need to maintain so they have driving access or even walk-in access, I've seen. And within the right-of-way, well, from a helicopter, they would like to spray herbicides to keep the vegetation low on the right of, in the right-of-way. They could do it from a truck while driving on the right-of-way, so they could do it that way also. And, of course, they could be prevented from spraying herbicides if they're in a sensitive habitat regardless. But if they are allowed to, that's the way they'd like to apply that. And, again, they do need to keep the right-of-way clear of taller trees. That's just about all I really want to say on operations and maintenance. It varies so much between utility companies. I just don't have a definitive on, yes, we're doing it yearly, or any guiding agency says, yes, you need to do this every year, every 5 years. So it varies. Of course, any problems that they find, they're going to need to get in there and resolve those problems. So that's when you're going to have traffic on the right-of-way. Other than that, though, they shouldn't be in there a whole lot. That's really all I have to say on operations and maintenance also. Next slide. That's it. I gave you my email and phone number. If anybody had any questions later on, certainly feel free to give me a call or shoot me an email.
Great. Okay, well, it looks like we're going to be ending just a few minutes early. So with that, I'd like to thank the Bureau of Land Management and Karen Stackpole for their time today. As I mentioned before, the presentation files will be made available on the Knowledge Resource Center at a later date. And if you have further questions for the Bureau of Land Management, please contact somebody on the slide showing on your screen. And this concludes today's webinar. So thank you for participating, and goodbye.